we've learned one way to think about mindfulness. There are a lot of different ways that we can define mindfulness, a lot of different ways that we can organize the path to human happiness. Are you familiar with the story of the blind men and the elephant?
Yes.
You probably have a name for that in Hebrew, right? That's that, what do you call it? How do you say it? The peel is elephant.
Five men.
The blind men.
Only one?
Three men.
Plural. So the blind men and the elephant. So a bunch of blind men are trying to come to an agreement about what an elephant is. So one says an elephant is like sharp and pointy. The other one says an elephant is like a rope. Another one says an elephant is like a pillar. Another one says the elephant is like a wall. Another one says the elephant is like a hose. Okay? Well, they're all describing parts of the elephant. So it's true. These are all aspects of the elephant. Now, this story is well known around the world, but what most people don't know is that it comes from Buddhism originally. It's from India. And it's a metaphor for the path to enlightenment. Different teachers will tend to emphasize different sides of this path. And it's too bad because it's very confusing to students. It's like, well, is the path this way? Is it like a rope? Or is it sharp and pointy? Or is it like a wall? Or is it like a pillar? Or is it like a hose? Well, it's all true. These are all ways of their perspectives to look at the same animal. To describe the whole animal at once is very, very difficult. We can't say it's very difficult. So different teachers are going to emphasize different sides of it. And that's okay because different students at different times in their career will relate more to a rope or to a hose or to a pillar and so forth. So each of us who teaches this classical path, well, we have our own styles, we have our own emphasis. So I gave you one way to think about mindfulness. It's what I like to use, but there are other ways, and you might want to think about it in a different way. So if we follow this way of thinking about things, so we can define mindfulness as a kind of attentional skill set involving concentration, sensory clarity, and equanimity. So we learned that. So that's sort of what is mindfulness. Now, the next question, which I attempted to answer yesterday in a rather full form, is why practice mindfulness? Why spend time and energy doing exercises like this? And the quick answer is to be happy as a human being. However, there are many sides to human happiness. But I would claim that if you elevate your base level of concentration, clarity, and equanimity, that will help you with all sides of the issue of happiness. Every single dimension of happiness is aided by having these skills. So it's sort of like learning how to read. Once you can read, you can a whole world becomes available to you. Reading is one skill, but with that skill you can read science books, you can read literature, you can read entertainment, and so forth. So once you have these core skills, then whatever facet of happiness you want to work on, you'll have a greater strength in doing so. So when you ask yourself, well, what am I doing here? Why am I doing this? This is like weird and it's uncomfortable and it's confusing. Just think about what would make you happy and then see, is it not the case that the skills that we're cultivating here would be related to that form of happiness? So yesterday I talked about many dimensions of human happiness. Surface happiness, and then very, very deep happiness, happiness that is really a spiritual happiness, and so forth. So that sort of answers, at least begins to answer the question of, well, what is mindfulness? Why practice mindfulness? Now, there's some other questions that we could ask about mindfulness besides what is it and why practice it. We could ask the question, where did it come from? How did this concept evolve historically? And we could ask ourselves also where it might be going in the future, because things have a past. They have a where they come from, and they have a future. They have or go to. So, I'm going to tell you a story about something that happened to me that very much broadened my perspective on where mindfulness came from. Any event, when I started to practice, I was a scholar of Buddhism. So I had studied Buddhism academically. And I went to Japan to live in a Buddhist temple. At first, I thought I was just going to do more academic study, but they forced me to meditate, fortunately. That's probably the best thing that ever happened to me in my life. Although, as I said, all the things that many of you are going through, the confusion, the discomfort, the fear, I totally understand that. But, you know, you could leave. I was stuck in Japan. it was a bigger deal to get out. So, yeah, I know what you're going through, and boy, did I go through it initially. I said it's hard for me to answer questions if you put them up writing, right? So I counted now 30 questions up there. Okay, I understand. You have questions. Yesterday I talked a little bit about learning how to accept not having answers as an entire practice, okay? In Zen, that's called don't know mind. It's interesting, okay? So the Christians discovered it, the ancient Greeks, the Chinese. I guess we never discovered this, huh? The Jews? We never discovered having equanimity with not knowing. All these other civilizations did. Well, we can learn from them. Maybe you're not all Jewish, I'm sorry, but most of you are. So the ones that aren't, your culture discovered it. Good. We're learning. We're still learning how to accept not having answers, at least for a little while. It's an entire path. Okay, so, equanimity with don't know. I'm still going to try to figure out how to answer your question, so I'll get back to you on that, time-wise. So I was there in Japan, and I was familiar with Buddhist meditation. I had studied it academically. And in fact, Buddhist meditation was the only meditation I was actually familiar with. I actually didn't know that there were other forms of meditation. I actually thought that only Buddhists had meditation techniques. So I told you about my first Zen retreat, how I almost lost my mind and almost passed out from pain, but something incredible happened. Well, that wasn't my last Zen retreat. I did others in Japan. And at one of the Zen retreats in Japan, by that time I'd sat for a few years, so things weren't so horrible. So I come in and, you know, I sit down in the meditation hall, and the people start to come in that are doing the retreat. And I noticed that there was another foreigner there, other non-Japanese person, a Western person. Now, this is a long time ago. There weren't that many foreigners in Japan. Being a foreigner was a rare thing in Japan. So it's like, wow, there's another foreigner here. He's like coming to do Zen. But there was more to it than that. He was a Catholic priest with a Roman collar, Roman Catholic priest. Now, at that time in my life, I had actually never talked to a Catholic priest. I was, what can I say? You know, you grow up in a certain environment and you have certain, you inherit certain fears. So, it's like, so I'm thinking, wow, first of all, what's this Catholic priest doing at this Zen Buddhist retreat, number one? And number two, I'm thinking, this poor schnook doesn't know what he's in for. You understand what I mean? A schnook, it's like Yiddish, it's like what?
Yeah.
Like a guy that is clueless, doesn't know what's going to happen, okay? okay, this poor guy doesn't know what he's in for. Because I already described to you what it's like, right? Well, you can pretty much tell how much meditation experience a person has by how they sit. Depth of settledness that comes with years of practice. So this guy gets on the zafu, perfect lotus posture, and... He's sitting like a Zen master. okay. So, at the break time, I go up and I introduce myself. So, he's from Ireland. He's what's called a Jesuit. That's a certain order within the Catholic Church. he's an Irish Jesuit priest who lives in Japan. He's sent as a missionary to Japan. And what they do is when the Jesuits send you to a country, they expect you to become a person of that country. So he might be Irish, but the church sent him to Japan, they expect him to become Japanese, to be able to speak Japanese, to live in Japan as a Japanese person. It's amazing. So, I mean, he's got perfect knowledge of Japanese. He teaches at a Japanese university. So this is the first Catholic priest I ever talked to in my life. His name was Father William Johnston. You can look him up on the internet. He's written many books. His first and most famous book is called Christian Zen. So this was my introduction to ecumenical dialogue. Okay, this is you understand what I mean? Dialogue between faiths. Okay. So it turns out that when the Catholic Church sends these Jesuits to Japan, they're Europeans, they're Christians. They are expected to go to a Zen temple and learn how to do Buddhist meditation because they will not be able to truly understand Japanese culture without having had that experience. It's extraordinary. I was amazed. So we became friends. And he let me stay they have a Jesuit house in Tokyo. It's all priests, except he traveled a lot. And so when I was in Tokyo, he let me stay at that center in his room. And in his room, he had a library on world mysticism, world meditation practice. He had books on how meditation is done in all of the religions of the world, a huge library on comparative meditation, because that was his specialty. That's what he taught at school, college. And so he let me just read in that his books. And it was extraordinary. It was like this huge broadening of my perspective. Because until I met him, as I say, I thought only Buddhists had a meditation tradition. And only Buddhists had the experiences of going into samadhi, the experiences of oneness, of true self, no self, enlightenment, whatever. So when I started to read, I discovered that actually similar things have been cultivated and understood elsewhere in the world, in Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Taoism, of course Hinduism, but that's the background of Buddhism. So it gave me a very wide perspective on what I was doing as a Buddhist practice. I now saw it within a more universal context. Now, personally, I still prefer the Buddhist context, because I think of all the formulations, it's the most systematic and clearly stated. But if you read carefully and if you read sensitively, you can see that maybe not quite as clear and as systematic as Buddhism, but you can see that similar things are known and cultivated historically, at least in the past. Unfortunately, much of the Christian contemplative tradition died out after the 16th century for various reasons that we won't go into. But in times before that, for a thousand years, Christianity was a meditation-centered religion. And many of you also know that there is traditional Jewish meditation. Maybe a little difficult to find really modern masters who could guide you in it. Many of the people that teach Jewish meditation are Buddhist trained at this point. That's also true now with the Christians. Many of the priests and nuns who are reviving meditation in Christianity are Buddhist trained. There's a whole Buddhist influence that has revived the meditation traditions of Judaism and Christianity that have been lost. It's really interesting. I mean, it's actually sort of amazing when you think about it. some of those rabbis whose books you read that teach Buddhist Jewish meditation used to come to my retreats in the United States, okay? So, anyway, be that as it may, we live in a very interesting age. So I came to realize that this is really, yes, you know, I like to work with within the Buddhist system, but this is really a universal human thing that we're doing here. So where did it come from? Where did it start? How did it evolve into the form that we're now doing? And where might it go in the future? I think these are interesting questions. So if I had to make a guess, and by the it, I mean meditation, enlightenment, mindfulness, all this sort of stuff. The contemplative endeavor, it's what it's called sometimes in the West. If I had to make a guess where it came from, I would say it probably started with our tribal ancestors. For most of human history, I mean, human history is hundreds of thousands of years, presumably, humans have been around. Writing has only been around for about 5,000 years, okay? So for most of our history, people lived in tribal cultures. Now, one of the interesting things about coming from North America, or the Americas in general, actually, the Western Hemisphere, is that we still have tribal people there. I don't think you have much of it in the Eastern Hemisphere anymore. But we still have people that that maintain a tribal consciousness, American Indians. So that we actually can have the privilege of experiencing what their spiritual path was. So if you think about the situation of our remote ancestors, what was their life like? Well, their life was simple. There weren't books to read. Every day was more or less the same. Their life was uncomfortable. They didn't have medicine. In the cold parts of the United States, like Minnesota, okay, you can barely stand to live there now, okay, with central heating and everything underground, okay, it's still almost unbearable to live in Wisconsin or Minnesota in the winter. How did Indians do it in teepees and buckskin clothes? Life was uncomfortable. And life was full of things you could never understand. Where does lightning come from? How is it that every month a mature woman can bleed without dying? What's that mean? It's a mystery, okay? Where do babies come from? Why do the crops grow some years and not grow other years? Full of things. What is an eclipse? Is it a monster eating up the moon? Life was full of things you just could not understand. And life was simple, and life was uncomfortable by modern standards. Got injured? You just had to be injured. No aspirins, okay? So what can you do under those circumstances? And that's the normal human condition. We're the ones that are different. We're the ones that have a lot of answers. We're the ones that have a comfortable life. We're the ones that have a very complex life. But most humans, for most of our history, it was very much different. Life's simple. Life's uncomfortable, and life's full of things you'll never be able to understand. Mystery. Life's full of mystery. So what would human beings do in response to this? Well, I would suggest to you there's two things human beings can do in response to our original condition. One is you can try to start figuring out the answers to things. And you can start developing technologies to make life more comfortable. That's what happened. And in the process, it worked. We now have science. We now have without that, we'd be out in the rain and the cold, okay, somehow enduring, okay? So that sort of worked. But there's something else that humans can do under these circumstances that sort of moves in the other direction. And it has a certain validity also. Things are uncomfortable. Well, you can just accept the discomfort, not fight with it. Things are full of mystery. Well, you can just let go of the need to have answers and surrender to the mystery. Life is simple. That means when you do things, there's not a lot of distractions. You can naturally fall into a state of concentration. Think about the Eskimo that cuts a hole in the ice in winter and squats with a spear. Now, sometime in the next 2 days, a seal is going to come up through that hole for about 30 seconds to get breath, okay? And so you're squatting in the winter, in the cold, exposed, holding that posture and looking at that hole. And if your attention wanders for 30 seconds, you may starve to death. Think about that, okay? That's sort of the way most people had to live at one time. But I think you can see that that lifestyle could be conducive to concentration, sensory clarity. You don't want your attention to wander, right? And equanimity. You're just like squatting in one posture in a blizzard for 2 days. So I think that mindfulness was there. Not in any organized way, not in any systematic way. It was just there for most human beings, for most of our history. But then there was this other thing, okay? So can you see? I'm not trying to idealize our prehistoric ancestors because they did warfare and they were, I mean, American Indians, they tortured their enemies. I mean, they did a lot of bad stuff. And there was a lot of conflict and things. Don't get me wrong, I'm not idealizing some myth of the noble savage, okay, as it was once. But I am saying that probably these things that we now have to cultivate systematically probably came a little more naturally to our remote ancestors. So, I don't know if any of you have ever had the privilege of joining in with tribal people in their ceremonies. This is, as I say, I mean, the Eastern Hemisphere is really cool because you have all this history, right? Especially a place like this, right? Really, 10,000 years. But 10,000 years, now that's a long time. But that's not as long as 50,000 years. The kinds of ceremonies that are done in North America to this day go back tens of thousands of years. And it's still preserved. And they let us in, people who aren't Indians. They'll let us participate in sweat lodges, vision, even the sun dance. It's amazing that this is available to us. And what you'll discover is that their religion requires sacrifice. You can't ask God for anything without giving something. But they don't believe in ownership. So the only thing you actually could give would be from your own body. So maybe you have to go without food and water for 4 days. Maybe you have to be cut in some way. Or maybe sit all night just on one spot without going to sleep. So there's usually some sort of physical ordeal which would tend to put you into equanimity. Now, you'll remember that if you experience pain with equanimity, it purifies consciousness. Of course, if you experience pleasure with equanimity, it equally purifies consciousness. This is probably where it started, if I were to make a guess. In other words, it's actually natural for humans to be in a mindful state to a certain extent. But you'll remember this other thing. Okay, so life's uncomfortable, you can like just open to the pain. And then when we make a sacred ceremony, we're going to make life even more uncomfortable. And we're going to call it sacred. We're going to call it a sacred pain. And then if you could, in a ceremony, you have sacred pain, then the pains of ordinary life, suddenly they can be seen as sacred also. Ceremony, things get even simpler. If in a ceremony, everybody just does the same ritual over and over and over again. Everything is stereotyped, simplified, even more simple than daily life. So you make it more extreme. Life's simple, ceremony is even simpler. Life's uncomfortable, ceremony is even more uncomfortable. Life's full of mystery, well, mystery. Equanimity with don't know. After 4 days in 110 degree Fahrenheit blazing sun without any food or liquid, do you think that you know what day it is? Do you think you know what's up or down? Do you think you can even know who you are anymore? You cannot think. So you have to accept don't know mind. Equanimity with no answers at all. Okay. And a new kind of knowing, a kind of wisdom can arise within that. And a purification of the physicality and the emotionality can arise within. So life was simple, life was uncomfortable, life was full of mystery, and sacred ceremonies make it more so, and therefore make life sacred. And it's still done. It's still done to this day in North America. All the things I just mentioned. It's not in the newspapers. They won't let the press. They won't let anybody in. No videos, no recordings, but it still happens. Okay, so that's probably where it started. But you remember, I said that, well, there's two things you can do, and they both have validity. One is sort of get with the program and sort of go back. Go back and just open to that. Another is go forward. Let's figure stuff out. Maybe we can figure out what lightning really is. Maybe we can figure out why the crops work some years and not other years. So people started to figure things out, and people started to get more comfortable, and people started to be able to organize larger groups of society into cities with specialties. Then they figured out how to write. Then they figured out how to do elementary mathematics. And they started to observe the heavens and develop geometry and the rudiments of science. And then, particularly after the Renaissance in Europe, things just... So now what we have is, it's good. We have a lot of answers. All those questions that our ancestors didn't know, like, what's the menstrual cycle? I mean, you have no idea how weird that is. It's not weird to us, okay, because we understand medicine and physiology. Anyway, still weird to American Indians. They have a whole lot of stuff around it, okay? So we got answers, and we got comfortable, and we lost our simple lifestyle. Now things are complicated. We have all these civilization and the complexities that go with it. So what I'm imagining is that as civilizations began to develop, people couldn't just beat a drum and go without food for 4 days and enter a spirit. They needed something more systematic. So meditation techniques began to develop. All around the world, different civilizations, as they developed their own, some civilizations developed their own meditation technique. However, without doubt, among all the civilizations of the world, the place where meditation techniques were most systematically developed is India. That is something that can be India's pride, that India can stand and, say to the world, as far as systematic ways to go about cultivating consciousness, our civilization has exceeded all others. So when we look around the world and we see the different systems of meditation, someone asked, what's the relationship of mindfulness to meditation? So we could say, I would say that it's as follows. Every form of meditation that I know of around the world, be it Christian, Islamic, Buddhist, Jewish, what have you, what you will find that is the common denominator for all of them, they may have very different philosophies, they may have very different lifestyle and ethical sort of specifics, customs, very different. However, there is something that you can see that's universal to all of them. Everything that's worthy of the name meditation will at very least increase your concentration power. It will elevate your base level of concentration. So, by base level of concentration, I mean how concentrated you are when you're not particularly trying to be concentrated. So, for example, in the Christian tradition, the state of concentration is called recollection. In Latin, recollectio. Now, ordinarily in English, recollection means to remember, but that's not what it means as a technical term in Christianity. What recollection means is to recollect. Your attention scatters, you recollect it, you gather it back. So, if you were to read, for example, the works of St. Teresa of Avila, this was a 16th century Catholic who lived in Spain, and she belonged to an order, a Christian order, that started here, not too far from here. Do you know where? Well, it's Haifa. Yes, they're called Carmelites. So the Carmelite order was one of the main meditation orders in Christianity. And like in Buddhism, we have something called the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification by Buddha Gosa, and it's sort of like outlines various stages that you go through from beginning to end. Well, St. Teresa wrote a book towards the end of her life where she outlines the stages that she went through over a period of many, many decades of practicing Catholic meditation. She lived in the 16th century. That book is called The Interior Castle. That's the name in English, Las Hadas in Spanish. It's translated into English, probably other languages. That is the standard meditation manual for Catholic Christians. It's a manual. It says you do this, and then this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. Well, I read that in Father Johnston's library, and I was amazed because it is almost in one-to-one correspondence with the Buddhist map. He knew nothing of Buddhism. I mean, nothing. 16th century Spain, they didn't even know what Buddhism was. And I can promise you that Buddhaghosa knew nothing of Catholicism. Yet, if you've had the experience yourself, when you read, if you read carefully, you can see, oh yeah, the religion is very different, the culture is very different, the philosophy, the language is different, but look carefully. There's some fundamental similarity here. So what does she describe? Well, it starts out with learning how to discipline yourself and control your ethical behavior. That's where she starts. And that's where Buddhism starts. It's called Sila. That's also where the Yoga Sutras, the classical Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, start with Yama and Niyama. Those are sort of like your customs, your halakha, I guess would be the term, like, you know, your observances and that kind of stuff. So it starts, if you look at St. Teresa, it starts with, okay, examining and your behavior, your ethics, getting that in order. Buddhism, same thing. We have the fourfold and fivefold sila. Fourfold sila is required for all humans. It's universal. And by the way, in the 10 used in Judaism and Christianity, the four are included, sort of, in those 10. So not taking life, not taking what's not given, not speaking falsehoods, and not doing things in the sexual domain that would be harmful to people, like non-consensual things or cheating, that kind of stuff. So those are the four universal ethical guidelines, sila. And then there's a fifth, which is not universal, but is something that some Buddhists take on and others don't. And the fifth is what? What's the fifth sila? Not taking intoxicants, mainly liquor and that kind of stuff. But that's not put on the same level as the other four. The other four are for all humans. That's universal. But not using intoxicants, that's like, okay, if you want to do that, fine. But if you don't want to do that, well, it's not absolutely required. So, and then in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which is a Hindu formulation, you have what they call yama and niyama, okay, which are sort of like observances. So that's where it starts. What comes next? Well, what comes next is a sequence of ever-deepening states of concentration. There's light concentration, and then there's deeper concentration, and then there's really deep concentration, and then there's even deeper concentration. So, in the Buddhist system, the various levels of concentration are formulated into what are called the jhanas, J-H-A-N-A. There's a system of four jhanas, there's a system of eight jhanas, there's a system of nine jhanas. Okay, it'd be a little confusing, but basically what these represent is progressively deeper states of concentration. Now, in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, they distinguish three levels of concentration. And words are used. I won't give you the vocabulary, but they distinguish three levels. If you read St. Teresa of Avila, she distinguishes more levels. A little more, larger number than Patanjali, but not as many as the Buddhist jhanas. But if you look carefully, it's the same sequence. Some divide it up a little more detailed, some not as detailed, but it's the same sequence, ever deepening states of concentration.
Can you repeat the name of the book?
Which one?
St.
Teresa of Avila, Santa Teresa de Avila in Spanish, T-E-R-E-S-A-D-E-A-V-A-L-I. Avila is a place in Spain where she lived. And she was, her order was called the Carmelite Order. And every Spanish-speaking person reads her works, just like every English-speaking person reads Shakespeare, because her essays are considered to be among the best writing in Spanish for prose writing. So it's just easy to find on the internet.
The name of the specific book?
The name of the book is The Interior Castle. Las Moradas in Spanish. So she compares the spiritual path to a castle that has concentric, like, walls and moats, okay? And there are seven concentric circles. And God is at the center. So in order to get to God, first you have to go through these ethical things, then you have to go through progressively deeper states of concentration. Then you have an experience that is beyond concentration. And she describes that experience. And anyone who is familiar with the Buddhist formulation can see that what she's describing is what in Buddhism we call stream entry. That's the initial enlightenment experience. That's when you permanently see the true self, or the no self, however you want to put it. In the yoga system, it's said that you experience the true self, okay? Who, the true witness, pure consciousness in the yoga system. In the Buddhist system, it's said that you experience no self. Now, it would seem that they must be talking about the exact opposite thing, but that doesn't really quite make sense. Because the path there is the same. It's the same sequence, okay? Plus, if you talk to a Hindu master who is realized, if you're around a Hindu master who is realized and you're around a Buddhist master who is realized, you realize they're coming from the same place. And guess what? Nowadays, they do too, because there's more dialogue that goes on. So all the meditations around the world recognize that there's a sequence of progressively deepening concentration. And it was just amazing to me, because I had studied the Buddhist formulations, to read something that was so similar in a religion that had no historical connection to Buddhism whatsoever. That was a huge aha for me, that this must be something universal. This must be something natural for humans in general. Otherwise, how can completely different cultures, completely different philosophies come to similar experiences? So that gives me a lot of confidence not to be afraid of this path. That this is natural for humans. I know it might seem artificial, it might seem weird, it's like, my God, what's going to happen to me? You know, human beings, what we're doing here has been done by thousands and thousands of human beings, probably mostly in prehistory. What's happened now is, as civilization arises, we start to get systems, techniques, conceptual models. And of course, on the surface, they may seem sort of different, but when you sort of get deeply into them, you can see they may differ in the details, but there is some fundamental similarity. So it starts with sila in Buddhism, your ethics. Then you develop samadhi, concentration. Then you go beyond concentration to get insight and purification. And that's called prajna, or wisdom. So each of the Buddhist traditions has concentration, but they each build wisdom in a slightly different way. In the Vipassana way of working, you build wisdom by carefully observing and opening to experience. So when you bring so mindfulness has the concentration that link, and that's universal to all forms of meditation. What's distinct about mindfulness, what makes it different from other kinds of meditation, is that it systematically develops the clarity and the equanimity. Other forms of meditation may develop clarity and equanimity, but typically they don't do it in a systematic way. Mindfulness does it in a systematic way. There's these procedures, and it will make your senses clear. And we have this concept of what equanimity is. And, you know, you can relax the body, you can drop the judgments, etc., etc. So there's ways of going about the equanimity piece. So I would say that in the big picture, broadly, what we're doing here is older and wider than Buddhism. It comes from the past of humanity. It's been systematized in different ways by different cultures. And as I say, I think that personally, I think the Buddhist one is the most clear and the most systematic. That's why I like it. I like to teach it. So that's how I see where this came from. And as I say, when I think how broad the basis is, and when I think how many human beings have come this way, have done this path, in the different cultures, in the different ages, then that gives me a kind of confidence that it's safe and natural and so forth. So I just wanted to sort of share my big picture view of what we do here with you. And so now we have a pretty good idea of what mindful awareness is. We have a pretty good idea of where mindful awareness came from.
Where it's going to.
Now, where is it going to? Well, that would probably be maybe not tomorrow's talk, but maybe day after tomorrow, or maybe the last day, because there's some other questions. So you all have a lot of little questions, but my goal is to get a few big questions answered, like what is it, why do it, where did it come from, and a couple other questions is how do you develop it, what do you need in order to be successful with this path? Then we can speculate on where this may be going. Because one of the things that the Buddha taught is anicca, impermanence. Things change. The original Buddhist practice, as far as we know, was something like what we're doing here. It wasn't identical, obviously, but it was something like what we're doing here. By that I mean, it involved being concentrated, separating sensory experiences. The Buddha didn't use see and hear and feel. And okay, he used the five aggregates, or the four foundations of mindfulness, or the four great elements. He cut up the pie in a different way, but it's the same general idea. So what we're doing here is something like early Buddhism. You see, the Buddha learned the concentration from masters who already existed in India. He had two teachers, Arada Kalama and Uttakarama Putta. And they taught him the whole sequence of the jhanas, all the different levels of concentration. And he was able to master them very quickly. But it was the genius of the Buddha to realize that concentration alone might not be enough. For some people, concentration alone will do it. But for many people, concentration alone isn't enough. They just, year after year, they're concentrated on the breath. Life is a little bit better, but not dramatically evolving. So the Buddha, after he mastered all these concentration techniques, he thought, no, there's something more to this path than just concentration. And what he did after that was he joined a group of ascetics. Okay, so what's asceticism? Asceticism is an unclear form of equanimity, is what it is. Okay? Asceticism is the idea that the more it hurts, the more it purifies. Okay? So the more it hurts, the more it purifies. So if you want to purify consciousness, torture yourself. Okay? That's an oversimplified view, but that's asceticism. The Buddha joined a group of ascetics, proto-jains, or jains, and that was their philosophy. And he outdid everyone in self-torture. So, like, you would eat 16 beans one day, that's all. When it was the full moon, and then the next day, he would eat 15 beans. And the next day, he would eat 14 beans, okay? Until the full moon had, you know, gone through like 15 days, right? And then he would increase. And he got down to one bean, and then he would increase back to 60. So he'd keep that up for a month, okay? So starving himself. Or holding his breath until he couldn't bear it anymore. Or being in intense hot or intense cold. So that's the kind of things they did. And he did that, and he outdid everyone in asceticism. But then he realized that, no, this isn't doing it, okay? Now, most of the standard histories will say the Buddha rejected asceticism. He rejected. Well, he rejected the lifestyle of extreme self-torture. That is true. But I would not exactly say he rejected asceticism. I would prefer to say he refined asceticism, both conceptually and practically. What did he refine it into? The concept of equanimity. Yes, if it hurts and you open to that, that purifies consciousness, but it's not so much the hurt, but it's the openness that's purifying. And equanimity is a much more mature concept because it works for pleasure too. Okay? You have pleasure and you let it come and go without push and pull. That purifies just as good as pain. So I would say that he refined asceticism. And how this came about was that he started to eat again. He sat under a tree. And he went into a deep state of concentration that he already knew. And all sorts of stuff started to come up. Maybe some of you have had this, where you see weird stuff. Frightening stuff, it's like, or sexual tempting images or violent images. He sat all night and he started to see a lot of weird things. And he started to have a lot of feel in, and he just observed. And he didn't get up, so there's a lot of pain after 5-6 hours sitting, okay? But he just had equanimity with it. He's in a state of high concentration. And he carefully observed. He observed, how does the sense of self arise? okay, broke it down into its pieces, he discovered something new. Concentration had been known. He inherited that. Asceticism had been known. He evolved that. He modified that. He refined that from the notion of the more it hurts, the more it purifies, to the notion of the more you open to it, the more it purifies, and that works for pleasure or pain. So he went into equanimity, and then he carefully observed. He discovered a new dimension to spiritual practice, clarity. How does this sense of self actually arise? Where does it come from? Where does it go to? Like under a microscope, high resolution, sensory clarity. And sat all night, observed all that weird stuff in image field space, observed, analyzed how this limited identity arises and passes away. And when the night was up, as the morning star was rising, he finally became free and was awakened. And from that time on, they called him Buddha, which is a title, actually. It means the awakener. So I would say, historically, his significance is that, in a sense, he rediscovered something our ancient ancestors knew, but in a much more systematic way, actually formulated it, gave procedures and a conceptual framework, a model. He took concentration, used it, but had another element there. He took asceticism and modified it into equanimity. And then he took something that, as far as we, he came up with something that, as far as we know, no one had ever come up with, which is the notion that you could use sensory clarity to gain insight, really deep insight, into the spiritual nature or the transcendent nature of yourself. So he brought the clarity piece in there. And so the practice that we do here is by no means historically identical to his practice 2,500 years ago, but it's in the same general spirit. He taught that things change, anicca, impermanence. That was a central point, one of his central insights. And you'll notice it too. You've probably begun to notice, okay? Something comes up, but it changes and passes. And something else comes up, it changes. Anicca, impermanence. Well, everything changes. One of the things that changed over time was Buddhism itself. Some people didn't change. Some people held to the more early teachings, but other people saw, remember the elephant? Okay? There's a lot of sides to enlightenment. The Buddha emphasized the side called freedom from suffering. But there are other sides. And later teachers evolved new methods. Yes, it was based on the Buddha, but actually quite different. One of those methods is Zen, or Zens, plural, because there's several forms of Zen. They work in a very different way. They don't observe the way we do here. They either just sit, or they work on don't know mind with koans, or they try to merge with the outside world, which is a Taoist influence. Okay? So that's a whole other way of working. Yes, it's based on the Buddha, but it's a modification, a change that happened in East Asia. And then, even later, Vajrayana developed, which we now associate with. That's really different. There you're visualizing deities, you're doing rituals, all sorts of things that were completely absent in the historical Buddha's time, things he didn't do, things he actually discouraged. But it turns out there's sort of a place for that too. So elephant has a lot of signs. Though the Buddha taught anicca, impermanence, and Buddhism itself has shown anicca. It's change. Some parts change, some parts don't change. Now Buddhism's coming into the Western world, and it's changing fast, and in really interesting ways. And we'll talk about it.